Hey, everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have a perfect episode lined up for your enjoyment. We have two sponsors here to mention at the top. Environments for Humans are promoting their SAS Summit, something we talk about all the time here on Shop Talk Show. SAS meaning syntactically awesome style sheets, you know, that CSS preprocessor that rules. They're having a whole summit about it, an online conference. Check out the URL for that at sassummit.com and get 20% off registration with the coupon code SHOPTALKSHOW and Typekit. So I think they've sponsored before, but welcome back, Typekit, our favorite resource for using custom fonts on websites. They wanted us to tell you, and this is a feature that I've used a bunch, is that you can now use anything that's on Typekit locally too, like so in your local version of Illustrator or InDesign or Photoshop or whatever, you can use Typekit fonts there. So we'll tell you more about both those things later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off. Listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, front end podcast all about web design development. And this week, we're happy to announce we are sponsored by Taco Bell. Chris,
that came out of nowhere. Me and Taco Bell had a little conversation last night on Twitter. I was talking about how I wish that one of the items on the menu at Taco Bell was just random. Just give me like five things of anything that you have on the menu. So I like wrote how I would order that in JavaScript. Yeah. And they're like, should have been an infinite loop back. And now I have to retire from Twitter because Taco Bell responded to me.
You've like hit peak social media success.
Another thing that's interesting about this week's show, me and Dave are sitting shoulder to shoulder in Austin, Texas from the shed, the official Shop Talk Show shed here in Austin, Texas. And we have with us Mark Grabansky. Hey, Mark.
Hey guys.
What up? Yeah, we were just talking before the show. I feel like I've known Mark for years and years, and I don't think Dave and Mark met yet, but I'm sure they will at some point. But Dave remembers Mark from a totally different reason than I do. So I think of Mark as like JavaScript dude. and Dave's like, Mark is PHP dude.
Anyway. Yeah, PHP way back in the day, but yeah, I've been focused on JavaScript and user interfaces for the last like 10 plus years. So
yeah, right on. So, and you're a Midwesterner like me, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
All the way from Burnsville, Minnesota.
Burnsville. I was thinking Twin Cities, but I guess that's just
It's just south of Twin Cities.
Okay. Right on.
Yeah, but I've been a long time listener of the show. So everybody else that's listening, I'm just like you, listening away.
Yeah. You'd be a good politician. and every man from the great Midwest. So what's up, Mark? I know that you work on front end masters, which you can tell us all about. And that's is that your kind of full time focus at the moment?
Yeah, I've been focused on full front end masters for probably 5 or 6 months full time. And prior to that, it was just, running workshops and just trying to, give a platform to, experts to speak off of and teach. And then it turned into a whole video and subscription platform. So, you can learn from all these amazing people that I looked up to, and they came here and did a workshop and.
Yeah, it's kind of unique, right? It's video training stuff that you can subscribe to and get it, but it's not, it's also a in-person thing, right? You have them come do an in-person thing and record it.
Yep, exactly. So I mean, a little bit of history. I spent like 5 weeks, talking to myself on my computer, creating a, screencast course. And I found that process to be a little dehumanizing. I didn't enjoy the experience. There wasn't.
Yeah. And if you don't enjoy it, I suppose that comes across.
Exactly. Yeah. So if front end masters had existed in the past, I would have just spoke at it, right? I would have just flown out, given a workshop and had the videos for later and that kind of thing. But it didn't exist. So I created this environment where, you know, an expert can come teach in front of, you know, 15 people in person. And then we added a live stream component. So, you know, we usually have around 100 and 150 people around the world, for each of these workshops, and they can participate live and, you know, watch in full 720p video, the workshop going on, and then they can chat alongside with it. So you have a lot of interaction, a lot of questions coming at the teacher throughout the entire day.
Wow. So it's like full day workshops then from like my home office where I'm not wearing pants or sweatpants.
Well, we actually have a venue, right? So we have 15 people in person and over 100 people online.
Jeez.
So it's just like a normal workshop, except for there's a lot more interaction because you not only have the in-person class, but you also have the people all around the world, you know, participating at the same time. So it's kind of like a worldwide classroom, mm-hmm. you know, sort of in-person online hybrid thing.
And it's not a bunch of nobodies. It, like on your website, you have, you know, like Estelle Weil, Garen Means, Christopher Schmidt, people like that people
some
might know
of which
from
you'll
the
recognize
shop.
From the show.
Yeah, exactly.
But these are people who kind of like really, really specialize in one like specific part of web development, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And a little bit of backstory on that. I mean, I spoke at like 50, 60 different conferences and, you know, about all sorts of things, user interface, and just got to know these people, got to know how, what their strengths are, and just really wanted to learn from them in depth. Really, that's what it was. Cause you go to a conference, you get inspired, but, you know, I really wanted to learn from these people, like how to do the thing that they're talking about, right? Not just, you know, getting inspired and being like, okay, well, that was cool, but I don't know how to use it. You know, I don't know how to put it into my daily practice. So that's really what it was all about.
Cool.
I think what I like about it is I'm trying to remember that because we're down here in Austin. So I'm thinking of Austin things. There's that, what's that TV show or bands? It's a venue.
Austin City Limits.
Yeah. I think of this a little bit like Austin City Limits. Like it's a live show, but only like a few people can go to the live show. But the point of being on Austin City Limits is that it's like a high quality recording which the band uses to make a record or make a TV show or whatever. It's like the Austin City Limits of nerddom.
I smell a blurb.
Yeah, I mean, I have some big advisors who have like huge companies. They're like, you're like the reality TV of tech education. And I'm like, well, kind of, except minus like the... Yeah.
Drama.
Weird stuff. Yeah. But I mean, we do get a little bit of drama, right? There's, students in person that are.
Go on.
You know, going back and forth with Douglas Crockford. He's getting upset and, you know, talking about dog balls and stuff like that. So there are stuff that, you know, that happens live. You know, people say weird things and do weird things and we just kind of leave it in there.
You know? You kind of hope people ask good questions because it's going to be immortalized, right? But
yeah, I mean, I love it. I love the back and forth dialogue. I mean, I think that's how we've learned, you know, throughout history. We've had, you know, a group of people discussing with somebody who has a lot of experience and they're not going to tell you like, this is the only way to do it. They're going to give you their experience, their opinions on how to actually do things, how to tackle things and the way that they tackle things. So I think that's, you know, one of the core strengths is it's not, you know, perfectly professionally recorded or, well, it's really well done, but, you know, weird things can happen. People can say opinions off the cuff and, you know, that's part of, you know, what I think makes it great.
Wonder Yak in the chat room is calling it keeping up with the Crockfordians. I think that's a good, that's perfect. I love it.
Kyle Simpson's course right now on advanced JavaScript is actually like the top on the platform. He did an amazing job, and yeah, all these guys are really great. So and gals.
So what else are you gonna keep in the game somehow? Are you taking on some freelance work too, or are you not at the moment? Or
well, I consulted full time for like 7 years and ran a consultancy. So, I built like 50 plus interfaces and that's great. But now I can just take all of that experience and roll it into one project, you know, and just keep iterating on it and that kind of stuff. So I'm not taking on any consulting at this time, but just focused on, you know, building out the platform and some of the things that people have been asking for. So
cool. Well, sweet. We should probably get into kind of the meat and potatoes, but I think first we wanted to just kind of get a little sensitive announcement.
I have no idea what you're going to say.
So on Twitter, we had a previous guest get a creeper email.
Oh, right. This is a bummer.
Yeah, this is a bummer. But so got a creeper email from a guy who's like, "You're so pretty." I don't know. It was kind of like a stalkery email to one of our past guests. And we don't know exactly. Chris and I were talking about it before the show. We don't know exactly what we're going to do about this situation. We're thinking about like a code of conduct, but then how do you enforce that to people who listen to a podcast? But I think what we wanted to say was like, our guests, like if you're listening to the show, we really appreciate that. And we want you to interact with the guests, but like in a very appropriate manner. They are busy. They take time to come on the show, to talk to us, to give us their expertise. And if we kind of start stalking our guests on the internet, we are kind of, the show won't go on basically, or like we'll lose valuable talent.
Who wants to say yes to a show that exposes them to sucky situations like that? They won't. And they will. Anyway, it's just good for you, the show, to not do that. You are not a friend of Shop Talk Show if you send a creeper email like that. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Please. Yeah.
So
that was a bummer thing to have happened, but I liked that we're going to try to take a stand on it as hard as we're able to do.
Yeah, because there's like the code of conduct, which is a popular thing for conferences. That's really great. But then can we like blacklist people's IP addresses for the podcast? What does it mean? Like, you know, and is that responsible? Did we just block out all of whatever Milwaukee or something by accident? Or
we just need to think about it and figure it out.
Anyway,
other drama news, I thought we talked a little bit about before the show, and we had, none of us are particularly clued in to what the drama actually was and how it went down. But Markdown is a weird thing. And I think all of us are aware that there's lots of different kinds of Markdown. And in fact, I have had this on my like to blog list for a while, all of the different kinds of Markdown and why you might pick them. Cause it's hard to make a choice, right? It's like, do you pick the one that has really good code fencing and code blocks? Or do you pick the one where you can put IDs on headers? Or do you pick ones?
The one with footnotes.
Yeah.
Or the one with ABBR, like abbreviations.
Sure.
Oh, man.
It's hard to pick the correct one, but the point is, it is a segmented world, right? Like the one that you probably download from daringfireball.net doesn't have any of that stuff in it, right? Like it's a more slow moving, standardized version of it. But the one that a lot of people use are one of these ones that have added features just because it's evolved over time. And so I think John Gruber was like, did he even start?
No,
it
was like people from like
somebody else
from Stack Overflow, GitHub, all these companies that are using Markdown on their platform like full time.
Yeah,
and they proposed this thing called Standard Markdown.
Oh, I see.
And they had emailed Gruber, but he didn't respond. Grubery. But then Gruber is very upset.
Like, yeah, don't call something Standard Markdown. That
right.
would be weird.
But it's also something he's done no effort to contain or standardize himself, mm-hmm. other than a post on his blog.
So we can see why this is drama, because there's good points on both sides.
So he's the IP owner, but not the IP protector, kind of? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense.
It'd be like if everyone started whatever, spray painting CodePen t-shirts.
And everybody, yeah. Like we might think that's kind of cool, but it would be kind of weird if, like, I don't know, there was a bunch of like localized versions of Front End Masters or something, and they use the name Front End Masters, but this is Front End Masters Cincinnati or something, and then a bunch of cities did that, and then some other, and then at first maybe Mark was like, that's cool, like let's grow this thing, let's go grassroots, and then somebody in New York is like, ooh, this is getting a little segmented. We're gonna start our own Front End Masters
standard, the best,
and then Mark's like, what?
Yeah, what did you follow that at all, Mark? Or
yeah, did you have any I mean, thoughts? Somewhat. Yeah, not really. I mean, you know, I guess I don't really have any opinions. I use Markdown; it's great. I use Textile; that's great. I mean, it really depends on the platform you're using and you know what flavor people are using on that platform, right?
Yeah.
So to me, that's it.
I feel like GitHub should take the lead.
I use GitHub Markdown, that flavor of Markdown, all the time.
Yeah, because that seems like the most mature or actively developed even.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I agree.
I need to investigate it a little more because there is we're in a funny situation with Markdown where I can look at a feature in every single little brand of it and be like, I like that. So I kind of want to make my own Markdown. It has all my favorite features in it. Anyway, since we're uneducated on this, maybe we should move on.
It's now called Common Markdown.
Oh my God. How does that solve anything?
Because they had to change it because Gruber took
offense. I suppose there's more weight to standard than common.
Yeah, standard and common are different. Anyway, they're commonmark.org. Enjoy. Good luck. Thanks. Next.
The wimpiest little pew there ever was.
We'll jump into the question and answer, but.
Yeah, well, let's just do one.
Let's get into some meat and taters here. Greg Tyler writes in, how do you prefer attaching JavaScript events to elements? I've previously used IDs and classes to match elements, but I'm working with a large group of developers and want us to have a suitable standard way. I think using a data-js attribute might be the way to go, but I'd be very happy to hear other options. This is for circumstances like, you know, select.
It's like binding a click handler. So like what, if you're binding a click handler, what is like the DOM query that you want to do it with? I feel like a lot of us in the past have just been like, you should attach these things to IDs. But all of us know, you know, what if you have 10 buttons and they all do essentially the same thing on the page? What do you do then? Do you use a class name, or as Greg is proposing here, do you do you query for elements that have this data attribute on them? I just thought maybe Mark would have an opinion. What if you had 10 buttons on the page? How do you bind click events to that, Mark?
Yeah, I would use classes or data attributes. I don't think it really matters too much. But I mean, pretty much all the projects that I've worked on lately use like an MVC framework or something, right? So anything, Backbone has its own, you know, way to attach, you know, actual views to elements. You know, render that view, and inside of that you put in your events. You know, Angular has its own way, React has its own way. So, I mean, usually you have to follow the existing, you know.
Right. What does it look like in Angular? Is it like...
Well, Angular does like ng dash something.
Okay.
Like, that's weird. Yeah. Or you have a directive or something like that, and it has behavior. But typically, I mean, I set up all of my events with event delegation, you know, initially when you load the application. So if the DOM changes or whatever.
Right. And I wonder, do you happen to know if there's a, like any kind of querying speed difference between a class and a data attribute? I don't know. You'd think that they would be about the same.
I think 2 years ago, it was a big deal.
Yeah. selector performance is not really a huge concern, especially when you're setting up event delegation, because, you know, it's not going to actually run that until, you know, a click event happens.
Yeah. And it doesn't even look for it. Right. It just,
right.
Like
it doesn't actually attach it to the DOM, especially if you're using like jQuery. It just, you know, takes all the selectors. And then when you click on something, it'll look up, you know, does this match the selector? So I don't know at the time of click, at least that's what I think. I think how it works.
On a current project, we're using Flyte to manage everything. That's like a component. It's like jQuery plugins for whatever. Like it's an architecture kind of like that. And we're using a JS prefix class. So like JS button. And that means the JavaScript will just look for that class. Like it's only looking for that class. So we're not binding to random styling classes that could change. We're binding to like JavaScript.
Yeah. That's what I like about Greg's technique here.
Yeah. The data.js seems smart.
Yeah. It seems like this has one purpose
and
it's
JavaScript. Concerns.
I'm not going to change. Yeah. I'm not going to be this weird long space separated chunk of classes.
And I'm not like,
Maybe that'll be the next movement, how we're all like, don't style anything with an ID ever. And that's caught on pretty good. We'll be like, don't attach JavaScript to classes ever.
Ever. Ever. I like this data.js thing, Greg. So
this framework you're using doesn't even prefix. Just like, isn't it weird that Angular just decided that they can have ng attributes without data prefixing?
Yeah, we're just making up attributes.
Because that's invalid, right? Does that bug nobody?
It would probably not validate well.
Yeah, but we just have stopped caring about that, apparently.
Apparently.
Well, at least when Mishko, he actually gave a workshop when it was Angular, like 0.6 beta or something like that, like way back in the day, before anybody knew about Angular. And what he said was like ng click, using something like in the DOM like that. Where, we took all that out, right? When we started saying this is best practice, let's take that out. And he's saying like, well, it's actually not a bad thing as long as, that click event has a scope attached to it. And so that's kind of the thing is that normal
scoped.
Yeah. Like normal, like on click, click event is in the global namespace. And that's what he's saying is actually wrong with that. So now, it's actually scoped to the controller that's wrapped around, the element, right?
Hmm.
So
I'm sure it doesn't have any like actual implications.
No implications other than if you were trying to be like 508C compliant or whatever.
It has to HTML.
Oh, you guys are talking about
validation?
Yeah.
I know. Yeah.
No, I'm just thinking if you were in like a super, this needs to be accessible role.
In the spec, if you use data dash, like data, like DATA dash, that's actually in the HTML5 spec. So that's completely valid.
Right.
And I think in Angular, there's a way to change like ng dash to actually data dash if you want to.
Okay.
Yeah. A little bit more.
But yeah, that's a validation thing. I don't really pay attention to that too much now.
I don't either, but I think it could be like a deal breaker for some people.
It's like one of those things where if you just prefix it with data, it sounds like it just works. Like Angular is smart enough about that. So if you really care, just do it that way.
Hey, yay, yay. All right.
Let's do a sponsor. Let's do Environments for Humans. Yeah. The URL for this is sassummit.com. So just like you can watch front-end master's stuff, you can sign up and watch their workshops online. It's just like this, but it's live, right? So it's a conference that you can go to and attend, and it's live, and the speakers are talking at you in real time, and you're asking questions in real time. You can attend it anywhere in the world. You attend it through your web browser. So if you sign up for Shop Talk Show, what's the date for? November 6th. Oh, that's interesting. November 6th happens to be the date of the first CodePen meetup as well. So you could go to this conference during the day, and then fly to Austin.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Or if you live in Austin, you can come to the CodePen meetup as well. But no, Thursday, November 6th, it's all day. So it's 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And you can attend it, without your pants on or whatever. You use coupon code ShopTalkShow for 20% off it. And just watch people talking about SaaS all day. Let's see, Elise Holiday talking about streamlining your SaaS. Stu Robsert, who does the SaaS newsletter that you should sign up for. Micah Godbolt, that I talked about the other day, talking about who does all kinds of screencasts about SaaS and is a
Snug
great teacher.
Going to be talking about grids, so
responsive layout. Beautiful. There's so much to talk about SaaS that it's no wonder it's kind of an all-day conference. It's going to be lovely. Use coupon code again, ShopTalkShow, for 20% off, and the URL is sassummit.com. You should get your work to buy a ticket for your whole office so your whole office can just sit around, pop in, make some popcorn,
yeah,
do some learning.
Yeah, you can do like group things.
Christopher, Chris, you've participated in Christopher's workshop or online conference stuff, right?
Totally.
Yeah. Teaching and watching them. I think they're great. I mean, Christopher's a good friend of mine. So
one of them, I had like this emergency day where I was planning on, wearing a nice shirt and doing it against a white background and stuff, but I had just moved and my internet was down. So I had to run to my neighbor's house and I'm like, can I do this here? They're like, yeah, but our baby is sleeping. I guess you can, but you're gonna have to do it in the garage. So So I like gave it in like a grungy t-shirt in their garage. And then like the lights went out behind me. You know, so if you don't like move around in your garage enough, the light will go off. And I was like, oh my God. And then I had to run and go find the button to open the garage. And then the sunlight just blasted the camera.
Oh man.
It was like the least professional thing I've ever done. People seem to like it, but I'm sure Christopher was like, cool move, dude.
Yeah. Something like that happened to me. Like I was on a road trip and I was speaking at Responsive Web Design Summit on jQuery Mobile, and I happened to be in Boston. So I actually asked Filament Group, hey, can I give this jQuery Mobile talk at your place? And they're like, sure. And I was like in some sort of like back closet in their office, like huddled over it, like barely wide enough for me to sit in, like giving this talk on jQuery Mobile at Filament Group, who created it, which was pretty sweet.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So thanks Environment for Humans for sponsoring. Let's,
all right. That should be an app. It's like, where's the like weirdest place you've done like a conference call? Like airplane bathroom or something. Okay. All right, here we go. Brian Curtin calls in or writes in here. I used to be heavy into PHP development and do most development there. I set up the HTML output from the back end, used minimal JavaScript for the front end functionality.
So he's an old school PHP developer. Back end for life.
With the explosion of all these JavaScript libraries in the past years, I've been developing a lot on the front end. I'm having a hard time finding a way to bridge my methods between front end JavaScript and back end PHP MySQL. Is there a good way to bridge these technologies, or are they not really compatible? And if they are not compatible, how can I take these detailed JSON strings I am building on the front end and store them somewhere for reuse, etc.?
So Brian is struggling with this new world of more front-end heavy apps, and can he reuse some of the skills that he has, I guess, in PHP land? Should he be like ditching MySQL and using something where he can maybe store JSON as the data format?
Mongo! I don't know. I'm just saying words I've heard. Mark, you have an opinion?
I think it's interesting. Yeah. Do you have any like initial thoughts, Mark?
Well, yeah. I mean, the backend to me kind of, you have to look at it like a JSON API, right? And you build out a JSON API, and then everything, you know, basically you can render your templates from that JSON in PHP with, you know, like parsing it and doing it that way. But you're going to have to write the, you know, template logic both on the server and in your, you know, client-side MVC or whatever. But like, you know, people like Basecamp say like, hey, that's the fastest way to do it. Like, you know, that's how you should be doing it, you know. But yeah, I mean, nowadays, if you're building like an admin panel that doesn't have to worry about like SEO and that kind of stuff, and just, you know, render it in your MVC, you know, framework, pull in the JSON, just render the HTML that way. I mean, that's kind of the view I have, is like render it on the server if, you know, you need SEO benefits and that kind of stuff. And, you know, there's new, you know, projects that are saying like, you know, here's the templating engine that runs both on the server and the client. And that stuff is cool too. But
that is cool. So as long as you've done the smart thing of making your back end speak JSON, essentially,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then you have your choice to go either direction. And so that, right. I mean, you've already taken that can't be difficult step, it sounds like. Or Brian is already comfortable working with JSON in either the front or back. So it sounds like he's in a good spot.
Yeah, just make sure you think about like when you're building out your web application or your website or whatever, just make sure that you have an API endpoint that just spits out the JSON that's related to that page. And you know, you can request that from the client with your JavaScript and render it, or you can, you know, embedded in the page in a, you know, global data variable or whatever. And, you know, mm-hmm. you can have access to it that way. And it doesn't have to be like one global JSON. It can be, you know, a bunch of little pieces in different, you know, data objects that, you know, are available to you in JavaScript, as well as, you know, you're rendering from that with your, you know, whatever templating you're doing on the server, right?
Yep. It's definitely an architectural choice. I don't know. I find sometimes it's nice to not have JSON on the back end. I just, you know, you're have an active record thing and you're just like, I'm just going to make HTML out of that. But at least, but I know that I could make it an JSON endpoint if I had to. Rails is really good at that, you know?
Yeah.
Give it to me either way.
I was going to say, do you have to worry about like get and post actions, like restful actions, or is that going, I guess like if you just were doing static PHP, that would already be handled. So it's really not a big deal, but I was just trying to think through, like if I'm just posting JSON to my server or something, I'm not making sense, but anyway.
I know Git always makes sense to be JSON because you're like, I'm asking for data. Here's some data in a nice format, but does that always make sense for post?
Yeah, I don't know. Mark?
Posts are just handling, you know, a form variable. So, you know, if you have a form, you can submit that via AJAX or a regular post, right? You just have to read the headers of, you know, did this come from, you know, did this come from the client, this request, you know, of all this data? Okay, I'm going to return back JSON. If it came from like a normal post, you know, okay, I need to render a new page.
Well, you can just tell by the post type or by the data that you get what the return should be.
By the headers. Basically when you send an AJAX request to the server, you can check if that's a XHR request and then respond, you know, back with a JSON, you know, success message or error message or whatever.
Smart. Okay. So yeah, you'd have to handle just a little bit of handling on your back end. But then, yeah. But it's probably easy enough to, it's a if statement basically, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Did this come from an XHR? Well, pass some JSON. Is it a regular post? Let's render a new page.
And then do you have to do all the success codes then too? Like 200, 304, 9,000, stuff like that?
Well, if you send back JSON, it's going to be a 200. But yeah, if you have an error, you can decide whether or not you want to send back the different codes, and on the client end you can basically read, you know, XHR dot, you know, status and see what, or I forget what it is, but just see what the response code is, right, from the server.
Yeah, so they're like
you can do that. Yeah,
I'm sure that's all useful to Brian, or if it's not, let us know.
Yeah.
Good luck with all your stuff.
Hopefully we got it pretty close.
We have one that this might morph into our. We have Typekit as a sponsor, and this is a question about font stuff. So we'll get talking about it, and then see if our sponsor can help with any of it. It's not intentional; it just works out that way. It's kind of an anonymous question, I guess, or somebody named Short Person sent us.
Short Person.
This question comes from Short Person, who started the question with a bunch of like what kind of page they're working on. But imagine it's a type of page in which that having a condensed typeface is necessary for the design of it, right? Like long headlines or a thing where it's just the design of the page really could benefit from having a condensed style typeface, and that is like narrow in width for individual characters. And they say there's a few typefaces from different foundries that would work for what I'm doing. Perfection isn't key, but finding the best, most legible experience across browsers and other devices is. However, I'm finding it difficult to compare them. So it needs a condensed typeface. It's trying to compare different ones from different services and finding trouble doing that. Hoffler Co. was my first choice, but because it seemed to be the most reliable across all the platforms, and it would allow me to you know, use all those fonts with one service, one price. But let's see. But the particular face that they want to use was not redesigned for the web. So I think they're in the process of moving fonts over for that. And I actually let me get through this whole question, but I wonder about that. Which made me question the idea that those really are the most reliable choices. If they're not all web ready, then what is? FontFont has a family that will work, that integrates with Typekit, that, or could be loaded from their own server, but they can't test it until they buy it. So that's a bummer. I've been starting to use Typecast, which is an app for, you know, trying out and testing web fonts kind of before you buy them. But they can't test the Hoffler Co. fonts in that because those aren't integrated. I've been using Typekit screenshots, but that's just, you know, a screenshot. So it's like, how do I be sure that this is working for us by just looking at it? the type kit is going to be somewhat of an investment for the client because, you know, fonts are expensive. So they kind of want to make sure that they're making a really good choice and testing it and trying it before they buy it. And so they're kind of like losing faith. They're like everywhere they think there's some kind of blocker in the way for being able to do this properly. So they're just like, ugh, I just have like Open Sans on there. They're like, screw it. I'm just going to leave it. I don't know. Do we have any advice about how, like if you are in this situation where you need this condensed typeface, you want to try it out in as many ways as you can, but for real with your own project.
And you don't want to just start shelling out your bucks client for fonts they're never going to use.
Yeah.
I don't know. Mark, you did client services for a while. Did you ever run into this or?
Yeah, I guess Font Squirrel doesn't really, you can package up a web font without them like checking the license of the font. So you can go to Font Squirrel, make your own, you know, make yourself a web
version of a
kit
font.
Yeah, sure. Whatever, a web font.
So if you can get your hands on the desktop version of the font, you can try it out on the web. And it's probably not a big problem if you don't make it live, right? You're just playing
right with it. Yeah, I mean, Font Squirrel doesn't check the license. So if you put it live, you know, you're at risk of being sued, right? But if you just, you know, put it through Font Squirrel, check it out local, you know, or on your test server, you know, have people check it out, you know, that's the best way to test it.
It seems like there's some roadblocks in here that, what was the person's name?
Short person.
Oh, yeah. Is roadblocks that might not actually be there. You know, like I think Hoffler, you know, Cloud Typography has free development projects for you to play with things before you have to pay for it, I think. Or do you have to buy the font first? And then I forget. That would be a little weird if there's absolutely no way to play with their things before you buy them. I would be surprised if that was the case. I know Typekit certainly has a free plan that you can make a project on and then try it out locally or whatever. There's definitely a way that you can do that without money. And if you're using Typecast, all the Typekit fonts are in there, as well as Google font stuff in there, and another group, I think. So that's a pretty good way to be trying things out. So I'm not exactly sure what the roadblocks are that you're having.
Yeah, it sounds to me like if testing is a big concern of yours, like I would probably go with something that you're going to have to eventually choose a platform because unless you want to buy into two platforms, you're either going to have to go with Hoffler or go with Typekit. Probably because they're sponsoring and probably because we just talked about it at the top of the show. Like they're like the fact that you can just like suck all these fonts like straight into Photoshop is pretty cool. And even building out a little kit just to test isn't super aggressive. I think maybe, you know, we've done this at Parabell, like we like fonts and we'll try out a half dozen on every client site. So we end up buying, at least like a personal license for everyone just to try things out. So, and that
can be part of the budget.
You may have to do like a $500 font budget for your client, you know, which that's just for you.
I can't tell you how many testing kits I have on Typekit. It's actually to the point where I should probably email them because when you open the drop down for your name kits, it's taller than the browser window. So it's hard for me to get to all the different kits I have. right. And you know, like Dave said, it's kind of like you are locked to one provider. You're not really, but if you were using multiple different cloud font providers, that's probably, even one is a significant performance consideration, yeah. And two would definitely be in the no territory, I think.
Yeah, but I like, if you're just testing, like in theory you don't need, I'm not a lawyer so don't listen to me, but like it seems fair use to me, Dave Rupert, that if you're just testing this isn't for public consumption, you probably don't need the special web license to get started just to test it. But you know, that may be false. So
I'm also interested. This whole thing started out with, I want a condensed font. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting. Like I've always, how can I word this? Like, what if that fails? If you design things that like only, like imagine a, like a book apart book mm-hmm. where the condensed font failed on the cover of it. It would just right. like totally blast out of the, of the thing. Like, how do you handle fallbacks for condensed font? That's always hard. I always pick impact.
Impact.
As the fallback.
Yeah. That's your only choice.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, iOS and all that maybe has like Avenir condensed now, but.
Right. Anyway, good luck. I know that was like a meandering, weird question, but any final thoughts?
Not to be too pitchy, but on November 14th, Jason Pimentel, he's a typography like expert. He has a workshop coming out.
Oh, nice. You got one coming up for Front of Masters all about type.
Yeah, it's called Responsive Typography. And he's like goes super in depth into like all the font stuff as well as, yeah, the responsive stuff. So I don't know. It's crazy like how in depth he goes. But yeah,
no, I've heard his talk at Artifact Conf and it's pretty nice. Sharp. So,
all right. Sharp dude.
Okay. So next.
So well, I guess that's it's weird timing to do this. But we might as well just do the spot. TypeKit literally is a sponsor of ours. It's the web font service that I've used the most. I have the most experience with TypeKit, and I have used all of them. I like different things about all of them, but I always kind of come back to TypeKit because I think it's just super robust. It's super designer friendly. The library is enormous. You know, mm-hmm. So if you're looking at, I want to have a account at one of these things. And what's kind of cool is that you can, you know, have one account and what you pay is a combination of all of your projects, right? It's not kind of like a per project basis or whatever. You just have like, this is all my projects combined or kind of represent this level of bandwidth and I'm going to pay for them all kind of combined. And that's definitely the number one feature for me, I think, is that kind of like robust library of fonts that you have access to when you go with TypeKit. They use JavaScript for the most part to get, you know, you can't self-host with them, for example, you know, but it kind of works out because I like how they kind of use the blocking nature of JavaScript to their advantage in this case. Like they use a blocking font because by the time it loads, then the fonts are ready and then they show. Like it's kind of a weird scenario where normally you're like, load JavaScript at the bottom, non-blocking, async, except for this. This should go on the head for sure.
Well, yeah. I think one advantage is they can do some of that negotiation. I don't know if you guys heard, but like WAF 2 came out and like it's supported in Chrome. I don't know if you spent the time this weekend like updating your Apache to serve WAF 2 fonts, but they did.
Oh, right.
So in theory, it could actually, you know, it could be faster.
Yeah, you get lots of advantages without doing any work.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. If you have Creative Cloud, which I do now, and I'm actually kind of a fan of it. There's like enough cool stuff in Creative Cloud. I'm glad I switched to it finally. For example, you can copy and paste inline SVG out of Illustrator. Like you couldn't do that in older versions. So now if you have like a shape selected in Illustrator, you just copy it and just paste it into HTML and it just comes along. Just that is awesome to me. But in the little like menu bar app that you have now with Creative Cloud, custom fonts are part of it. So you go to TypeKit, find a font that you like and want to use in print material or want to just use to mock out websites or whatever. And you can just click, oh, I'll just sync this down to my local machine. And you'll have that font available for all of the Creative Cloud apps, which like just that feature is pretty hot. I feel like that was like the question with web fonts from day one is like, oh, we can use fonts in the wake. Great. We're so happy now. But we need them in our desktop apps too, and for comps and for supportive print material and all that stuff. And now that this, you know, if you go the TypeKit route, you have that available to you.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty. On more questions.
More questions. This one is about WordPress. Here we go. Miles Gregory writes in, when designing WordPress websites, I'm constantly running into problems with render blocking CSS and JavaScript. I try to keep the amount of plugins that I install down to a minimum, but many times the few plugins I have installed will place links to CSS and JS files in the head of my site. Is there a best practices way to direct WordPress to run any CSS and JavaScript from plugins in the footer? I preferably would like to accomplish this without installing yet another plugin.
Oh, this is a classic question in WordPress, right? Let's say you have, and I use this on CSS Tricks, like WP polls. I want to have polls functionality built into my WordPress app. So I download a plugin. This plugin has a script, and it has JavaScript and it has CSS. And the way that it handles it is just injecting a link tag in the header and a script tag in the header to do this functionality. And you know, if you're investigating site performance or whatever, they're like load scripts in the footer. And then why does this have to be an additional CSS file? Can I just take the CSS file and concatenate it with the rest of my site CSS so it's not yet another HTTP request? Let's talk about this. And then I have some ideas. Mark, you use WordPress, right? I think I viewed source on your website to check it out.
Yeah, I actually have that problem too. I mean, the way I tackled it was on pages that don't use the plugins, CSS and JavaScript, you can DQ, you know, the CSS and JavaScript.
Where do you do that DQing in like functions.php or whatever?
Yeah. Or, you know,
make your own little plugin.
Yeah, exactly. Using hooks or whatever based on the page you're on. And then if you want to, you can embed that, you know, your own way. Which is a little bit hacky, but I don't know. How do you handle it, Chris?
I don't know. Sometimes I'll dig into the plugin, find where it's queuing up the CSS file, and just rip it out. And then take the CSS that came with the plugin and put it in my own project and use SAS to squish it all together. So then that CSS is available in my own project, whatever. But then I've committed a sin, right? I've altered a plugin. So as soon as that plugin is updated, it's a goner. So really you have to find the hook where it happens and unhook it. Yeah. And I'm so unconfident in that. Like that's just
the way that I did it. Actually, I'm pulling up code right now. I shouldn't be doing that. But the way I did it was, I found some snippet that like spits out all of the queued up styles and JavaScript, and I forget what the snippet is actually, but you can Google it and just see like what are the scripts and styles that are being queued on this page, and just like DQ them all, and then you know,
and give me a list of them. That would be interesting, so you'd know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, spit out the output of all of the, you know, plugins, and then just like DQ everything that you're not using. But also, you know, you can DQ the ones you are using and embed them in your own way, in your own build process if you want to. Mm-hmm. That works, but it is a little bit more custom.
It's tricky. So there's different ways to do it. You know, some people might, you know, be like, well, remember W3 Total Cache or whatever, which has the ability to look at all the different scripts and styles on your page, and it will concatenate them for you and stuff. That's a really cool feature. I'm glad that exists, but I always feel weird about, I always want to like do it myself, you know, so I know that I have control and I understand how it's all working. And I'm sure some people might laugh at me for that, but I'd prefer to do that. What I thought when I read this is like, I wonder if we could make like a manifesto website for WordPress plugins that says like, if you're a plugin developer and your plugin requires altering the theme in which to inject styles and scripts, what is an absolute best practice to do that? Or is it too complicated to do that? For one, I think if it's a script, shouldn't there at least, if it doesn't default to injecting itself in the WP footer hook, at least it should be an option. Like you should build in an option to your plugin that says that maybe it defaults to header, but allows you to change it to the footer or vice versa. It just uses the different hook depending on that setting. Or it's, and then for CSS, maybe it does the same thing, but you never load link, you never put scripts in the or styles in the footer, right? But maybe it could say, maybe the setting for CSS could be like, don't inject any settings. And then if you click that, it like exposes a text area with the CSS that you copy into your own project. Like, oh, I see you're not, you know, you don't want our CSS, but well, here's the CSS that we would have added. So feel free to add that to your own project, you know? Like that feels like best practice-y to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know.
I wonder,
are you familiar with the 14K? We should deliver our whole site in 14K.
Is that like the first packet or whatever?
The first like view. And then everything is asynchronous after that, like the CSS, the JavaScript, everything. Filmint Group is doing a lot of work with that. I mean, I think that everything should move to that. I mean, that's going to be a huge change in the way that we build websites, is let's deliver like everything in a tiny little package so that everybody has access to the content. And then everything is asynchronous after that. Everything is enhancing, you know, after that. And yeah, I mean, that should be, you know, we're going to have to figure out some tooling around that. I mean, there's tools now, Grunt file or Grunt scripts, that can see like what CSS you're not using in the page and then tell you, and then you can handle it that way. But yeah,
these plugins are in a weird world in that they need to work. So if they do too much fancy dancy stuff, people are going to screw it up and then they're going to leave bad reviews, or they're just,
yeah.
So it's always been kind of like the manifesto of WordPress to be like, this stuff works. Mm-hmm. Like, no matter what you do. And I think that's plugin author's general approach, is that they're going to do whatever they need to do so that the functionality of this plugin works. They have to do less customer support and stuff. And sometimes that can be at odds with performance best practices. So whatever manifesto, I'm serious about it. I at least want to write a blog post about it.
Yeah, I think my deal with like most WordPress plugins is they try to give you a UI. They try to give you all this functionality and stuff like that. I sort of wonder if it could work more like NPM or something, you know, where it's like this calendar literally just spits out a calendar, or like gives you JSON for a calendar, and I figure out my own calendar my own way, or something, you know, or like, and that's like the base module, and maybe there's a calendar dash UI widget, you know.
Yeah, that this does have some job. It feels like, remember when the conversation in jQuery was like, how much should you put in a plugin? Mm-hmm. You know, does it need to have 10 themes, and does it need to have 40 options?
Yeah.
Or not.
And there, each of these plugins, like a lot of them include their own copy of jQuery. So you end up with like a WordPress page with like three copies of jQuery of different versions.
Yeah, at least generally solve that with the enqueue thing. They said like enqueue.
Right. Yeah, I found the action. It's wp_print_scripts and wp_print_styles. And then you get like a PHP object of like where you can list out all of the enqueued, you know, styles and JavaScript. And then you can say like, I just want to dequeue all of these and then include, you know, minify with Grunt or something, and then include my own version. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, can be a little bit risky. You have to do a lot of tests.
And the results of that might be different depending on a page by page basis, right? So you'd have to be pretty careful.
Yeah. That's basically how I tackle it.
No, cool. I wonder what you could do just from a manifesto standpoint.
But I don't know. We'll talk though.
Yeah, there needs to be a better tooling around it for sure.
I know that Drupal dealt with this because they had this whole thing where every plugin author was kind of neckbearded and just was like, tables, boom, everything's a table. And so they had to kind of build up a culture where they kind of were just like, don't do that, jerkwads. Like, do responsible front end stuff. So, and they did it pretty successfully. I think so. It's the rumors.
Cool. Do we got time for another one here?
Yeah, we got a audio question.
Yeah, this should be interesting. It's regarding like, I don't know, professionality and somebody that found maybe a way to make some money in a way that some of us might think is okay or might think is slimy. I'm getting curious. A back-end view of how Dave handles audio questions.
Hey, what's up, Chris and Dave? You guys are awesome. Keep up the good work. Mark, I love the front-end masters, man. Keep that up. My name is James. I'm from Allentown, PA, and I have a quick philosophical question. So the question is this. You're all pros in a field that is still being defined, so probably will be for some time. So how do you both precisely articulate what is and what is not professional in this business? Now, here's to some background to illustrate what I mean. Yesterday, I had a conversation with someone. He's starting a web design company, but he's not a coder. He got in with a group of guys. They know how to make fast money by using Joomla templates. So I told him he wouldn't be successful in the long run if that was his approach, but he insisted that he's seen it done to great success. So I explained to him that true success comes by showing the craft respect, and by contributing to the advancement and development of the craft that is still evolving. So I told him flat out that by conducting himself in that way, he'd not only be doing his clients a disservice and ripping them off, but he'd also be giving the web development community, he'd be giving us a bad name. So I tried to talk to him about web standards, accessibility guidelines, how the design of user interface should be driven by the content, a whole bunch of stuff. I tried telling him about frameworks like Foundation, but he insisted there was no reason to touch the code if he could turn over a site in 2 days that looks good and it works. Mm-hmm. So in the end, my arguments were not convincing. So I was wondering how you would approach that. Thanks, guys.
I got a little opportunity for you, huh? I know. If he didn't listen to you, James, with like your raspy voice, then I really don't know,
I know
if he
man.
Can be convinced.
Yeah, I would you listen to anything me. You said. But he's kind of like, well, you know, no, you go, Mark.
Well, I definitely think that there are business developers and then there are developers, right? People who are, you know, all about the craft and that kind of thing. And the business developers couldn't care less if it works with Joomla or if it works with a, you know, subscription service that you can just like, what are those sites that you can just, you know, plunk in some WYSIWYG stuff and you're off to go and you charge the client, you know, X amount for it. So if it's like a money-making thing, and you just want to churn stuff and you're, you know, kind of a business developer type person, like, you know, that can work. I mean, it definitely can work.
I'm sure it does. That's the scary part, right? It's kind of like,
yeah, but when
you're down there monkeying with the code, you're not making any money down there. Yeah. Get up here.
Where he's like, I bet there's, you know, they're saying, you want a site? I'll build you a site by tomorrow. They go to Squarespace, they throw some high-res images in there, and they'll
and
be like,
you
see how beautiful
dollars.
This site is? Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a $5,000 site.
But when you need to do something custom or something breaks, you're basically just completely screwing
over. They just changed
their phone number. I mean, you're completely screwing over the person that you're building, you know, the thing for. So, I mean, if you're going to build it and be a part of the craft, you know, participate in open source and, you know, get a job at, you know, a product company or building, you know, nice sites for agencies and that kind of stuff. Like, you know, that's a different path, right? You're probably going to be more of a full-time, you know, employee doing, you know, awesome work versus, you know, being a business guy who's, you know, just turning over sites to make money.
I mean, it clearly feels gross. This guy that James is talking to is trying to be gross.
Yeah, he thinks of websites differently than we do.
But there's definitely room for, you know, the quick, hacky, dirty stuff.
Yes,
right?
That's the thing. That's gross, but it's not all the way gross. There is a kind of business to make low cost.
Saying even as us, as you, as me, whatever, like, you know, putting together like something, some quick landing page to see if people are interested in something or, you know, standing something up quick and writing some crappy jQuery code or whatever it ends up being like sometimes you just need to get stuff done to see if the idea has, you know, legs or, you know, you're just prototyping with, you know, a bootstrap type of thing or whatever, you know, there's room for that. You can make it nice and later, like if it warrants the effort, but you know, you don't want to be on the other end of the spectrum, which I've seen so often is people are just like crafting something just elegant and huge that nobody's actually going to use, right? Or, you know, elegant and perfect and performant and all that kind of stuff. And nobody's using it. So I think there's a balance there.
Yeah. I feel like it could be good for business. I mean, this guy's going to sell a website for however much money, and then it's not going to meet the needs, you know, of a company down the line, you know. So they may need a new website and they would probably want to talk to somebody else or something. But I mean, I'm thinking now, I'm like, maybe I put too much effort into websites, you know, maybe they should
sometimes
be built faster.
Sometimes we all do, right? I mean, we love the craft. So I've done it where I've spent, you know, 6 months building like a custom system and, you know, and Ruby and, you know, making it perfect with all the JavaScript and stuff. And like nobody ends up using that project, right? I just kind of wasted 6 months of my life because I was enjoying the process of building. And, you know, so I've been on both ends of the spectrum and I love WordPress because you can do custom things, but stand up a site quickly, you know, and then you can make it nicer later. Right?
Amen.
Yeah. I think this guy's going to have a tough time selling.
Well, he's going to crash and burn at some point.
Right. It sounds like, yeah, like the tires are just going to deflate.
Yeah. And someone who's shopping around for like the cheapest person, you know, to do their website is going to go to a guy like that. Right. And they're, oh, you can get my website up for, you know, $3,000 and it'll be up tomorrow. Like, heck yeah. And, you know, they'll do that. But then eventually, like, their site will blow up or they'll need some custom work done on it that the person can't, you know, do. And nobody knows, you know, the system it's built on and how it's built. So, you know, you're locking in your clients to pain in the future.
Did you ever read that? I think it was Sasha Grief wrote that article about the $5 logo or whatever, where he hired a bunch of people on 99 Designs to design a logo for a product.
Got a bunch of copyrighted stuff.
Yeah, they like, it's just like clip art. And then he just went over to Squarespace and made a logo. And then he made a logo himself, just like kind of a design exercise. And it's a pretty good read. Maybe we can find a link and put it in the show notes. But it was just interesting. I think it's the same problem, right? It's like, there's cheap and fast and, you know, but it's not it's not necessarily good. It's that good, fast, cheap triangle, right?
Yeah, pick two.
Yeah, pick two. You get two. So, and I think there's a market for it, obviously, because it happens and people do it. But I just don't know if it's like retire bucks, you know? Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I mean, that's what this guy's looking for.
Yeah. I put a billion.
It turns out you can buy
Google.
Gold, resell the gold that you buy for a profit. Yeah. He thinks he found this in web design, and I think that might not be the case.
Yeah. The materials are free, and I just give them to people.
Yeah. Yeah. You buy an apartment building, you see, and you rent out the apartments by the month.
And you don't even have to fix it up or nothing.
Nothing. You don't got to do nothing. These people live in squalor.
Yeah. if a wall falls down, it's a shared space.
Put up a shower curtain.
It's just as good as a wall. They don't need nothing. All right. Well, hey, that was really, I love these conundrums. That was a good one, James. Thank you very much. Apologize if we've bastardized an East Coast accent. All right. Well, it's that time.
We got to make sure that people know about giving away the user group.
Yeah, we do that on the out, and we forgot to do it at the top. But let's do it now. We normally ask about one thing you want to plug, and Mark has a really kind of awesome thing to plug other than Frontend or related to Frontend Masters.
Yeah,
so tell us about that.
It is. Yeah, so if you run a user group or you're part of a user group, which I'm assuming most of you are because you're awesome, you're listening to this kind of stuff, and, you know, you're...
What qualifies for that? Like Cincinnati JavaScript. I just made that
anything.
Up, but I assume there is one.
It could be you meeting with, you know, a few people. You know, I don't really care. Like, it just... A group of people getting together and learning, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, just reach out to Mark, M-A-R-C, at frontendmasters.com because we do giveaways and, you know, just let us know, like, your group size, where you're meeting and that kind of stuff. And we send out free licenses. You know, we want to support the user groups, the people who are out there, you know, trying to make the web better. So,
yeah, so your user group could be one of the meetings, could be sitting around watching a Frontend Masters thing and then talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but usually, you know, you have your Minneapolis JavaScript meetup or, you know, whatever. Those kind of user groups is typically what we give licenses to. Mm-hmm. So,
cool.
Just give away.
That's sweet.
Mark at frontendmasters.com.
Just email. Get your user group hooked smarter. That's a tagline you can use. So, Mark, if...
I'm going to use that soundbite from this episode and I'll be like... Your user group smarter.
Make your user group smarter. Yeah,
exactly.
So for people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Well,
Twitters and everything.
Yeah, one MARC on Twitter, and, you know, on Frontend Masters. I mean, if you click any email support or whatever, I'll be able to see it. So
cool, awesome. Well, thanks so much for taking time out of your day. We really appreciate it. Thanks to you guys for listening in the chat room, coming out live and downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. We really appreciate it. Be sure to vote us up favorite tweet and do all those things. That really makes a difference. And I don't think I have anything else, Chris.
ShopTalkShow.com.